Radio. I'm a pretty stubborn person, which I think is a blessing and a curse, you know? And so if I even think there's like the slightest possibility that it's possible, I'll just keep pounding my head against the wall.
Hey y'all, I'm Ryan Devlin, and welcome to the Struggle Climbing Show, where I talk with elite climbers about their struggles and breakthroughs in training, nutrition, tactics, and mental game. And oh my gosh, today we're chalking up for a chat with one of the most accomplished big wallers and single-pitch trad climbers the world has ever seen, Beth Rodden. Now, it's just hard to overstate Beth's impact on the sport, as she put up some of the hardest first ascents around, some of which have only seen a few repeats or none at all. So let me just hit you with a few of the highlights here before we jump in. In 1998, Beth became the youngest woman in the world to climb 514A or 8B plus with her send of to bolt or not to be, and then she just went crushing from there. In the year 2000, Beth, along with her partner Tommy Caldwell, established the first free ascent of the LCAP route, Lurking Fear, which has yet to see a repeat. That's how hard that one is. And then she and Tommy also freed the nose a few years after that, making Beth the first woman to free two routes on LCAP. And then Beth has also put up some insanely hard and technical single-pitch trad routes and sport climbs, including the Optimist, a 514B or 8C route in Smith. She was the first woman to on-site the Phoenix in Yosemite. And lastly, for me to cover here because I'm already getting too long-winded, Beth established the first ascent of what was the hardest trad route in the world at the time, Meltdown, still one of the hardest trad routes in the world, a highly technical 514C or 8C plus in Yosemite, that went a full decade before seeing a second ascent, and as Beth and I discuss in this conversation here, a route that could very likely be 9A. And maybe what's the most incredible here is that all of those amazing climbing accomplishments aren't even the most interesting or inspiring part of her story in my eyes. Today, Beth reads a handful of passages from her memoir, A Light Through the Cracks, which beautifully and painfully chronicles her formative years as a climber, the harrowing experience as she and her friends were taken captive and then managed to escape likely death in Kyrgyzstan when they were on a climbing trip, her relationship on and off the rock with Tommy Caldwell, her battle with disordered eating, how she turned her body into a climbing machine, and then the effects that all of those experiences had on her physically, mentally, and emotionally. I absolutely flew through this book. It's inspiring, it's tragic, it's real, it's joyful, it's all the everything. And we dive into all of it here today. This is a full value experience. Now, in a few different sections here today in this conversation with Beth, we talk about how she moves over granite, and she's an absolute icon in it, having done some of the hardest granite routes in the world. And there's a really technical aspect to that, and also just a really beautiful aspect to climbing on granite. And I'm really hyped to share that one of the sponsors of today's episode here is Arc'teryx and their insanely cool Climb Academy, which they're putting on in British Columbia again now for its 17th year up in Squamish. Y'all, I've chatted with Arc'teryx athletes Jonathan Segrist, Amity Warm, and Jordan Cannon about this event, and it sounds like pretty much the coolest experience you can get. I'm hoping to get out there myself for it because I really want to get back to my granite climbing roots, and I would love to see you all there. But you know what? We're all going to have to act fast here because no doubt it is going to sell out quickly like it always does. Here's what you get at the Climb Academy. It's an epic 3-day event geared towards all skill levels, and it includes clinics taught by top athletes, film premieres, live music, and just some of the most pristine granite the world has to offer. Man, Arc'teryx just knows how to do it right. The Climb Academy runs from August 23rd to the 25th out in beautiful Squamish, BC. And to view the clinic lineup and grab a spot, swing by thestruggleclimbingshow.com/climbacademy or just hit that link right there in your notes. The clinics go on sale May 9th. Let's go. I hope to see you there. This episode is sponsored by Petzl, and if you've seen the videos of me on my project lately, y'all have seen me in my Hirundos harness by Petzl, which I absolutely love. Y'all, if you're a sport climber, and if you're looking for something that's ultra light, ultra comfy, and does not get in the way at all as you make limit moves, this one is it. It's got fuse frame technology, which basically means that it's light, it's strong, and perhaps most important for me with my mental game, it gives me total peace of mind as I go for it and take a ton of falls in the process. And it is comfy when I'm taking those falls, let me tell you. Look, for me, Petzl is just synonymous with trust. From their gri-gri, to their draws and helmets and harnesses. I gear up with Petzl, and I also gear my kiddos up with Petzl as well. They just make the best stuff. You can check out all that Petzl has to offer at your local gear shop, or you can swing on over to thestruggleclimbingshow.com/Petzl to access the inaccessible. And lastly, just a big thanks to all you patrons and subscribers out there. I love you so much. I just dropped a really thoughtful bonus episode with Beth here just for you, and I'll tell you all more about that in a little bit here. But first, let's explore the dark and the light through the cracks with Beth Rodden. Well, it's so good to meet you. I feel like I know you. I'm sure you've been getting this as you've been going around on the book tour and all that, but having just absolutely torn through A Light Through the Cracks, I have such intimate knowledge of you and your inner workings, and you know nothing about me. Do you have any questions for me before we dive in?
No, it's totally true. It's like an awkward, lopsided relationship. Like, well, you know the inner workings of my mind and very vulnerable moments, but, you know, it's nice to meet you.
Right. Well, I think you and I are the same age. You just had a birthday, right? Happy birthday.
Yeah, mine's coming up in May.
Oh, it's May. Okay, so it'll be right after this comes out. So, yeah, and I've got two kiddos. I've got a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old. How old is Theo?
He's 9. So, yeah, very similar. Cool. Yeah, very similar.
Yeah. So my son, Ferris, is 9 and obsessed with Minecraft and Rubik's Cubes right now. What's Theo into?
Cool. He just got into Rubik's Cubes. Yeah, we were in France with some friends, and one of his friends is super into it. So he was like, oh, this seems fun. And he was into it too, which it just, like, my brain doesn't work like that. You know, I look at it and I'm just like, I literally have no idea what you're doing. I mean, I understand the concept that there's like an algorithm and you follow it, but
right.
I'm just, yeah, I feel like people have strengths and that's not one of mine.
It really is like such a crazy magic trick when I see him solve, and he's been teaching me how. And so, like, I can solve now, but it takes me like 10 minutes or so. And he's been able to solve. He can usually like get around like 30 or 45 seconds. And so it's like such a proud parent moment, but it's the first time where I'm like, you are legitimately better than me at something. You know, I'm like not letting him win. I'm not helping, you know, he's just like, he can do something better than me. And that's like a cool and kind of a weird feeling as a parent.
Yeah, no, I feel like it's pretty cool. Honestly, you're like, huh, that's pretty cool. You're your own autonomous being that's like totally excelling in different ways, you know?
Yeah, it's really great. I'm so grateful that you're able to take the time to dive in. I really, really enjoyed this book that you wrote, this memoir. It was beautiful and vulnerable. The prose was really lovely. I mean, just it read so fluidly and fast, but I really felt like I was there. You're quite gifted as a writer. And I listened to it, by the way. I was on a road trip with my family for spring break, so I got an advanced copy of the audiobook.
Yeah, I think you're the first person that I've talked to that has listened to it. But it was a fascinating experience because I'd never done anything like it before, honestly. You know, I talk to my family and my friends and that's about it. So, but no, I had two wonderful people helping me, somebody there in the studio and then a producer that was patched in. Yeah, it was an interesting experience. It was also very, very weird because it was probably the first time I've read the book from start to finish, you know, probably 9 months or something like that. And I was doing it in front of two men that I had never met. And as you know, there's like some pretty vulnerable things in there. So it was like slightly awkward, but I enjoyed it. It was hard, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed it. And for all who are listening, this is a book that if you're a reader, it's going to be a great read. If you're a listener, if you're an audiobook person, like I listened to it, it just moves really, really well. And it was like I tore through it, you know, just in a sitting. And it really affected me, Beth. I have to say, you know, I know I've known you as a climber forever. You're a climbing hero, but you really bared your soul, your heart, your soul. It was incredibly vulnerable, like you said, as you're sitting there and reading this in front of two guys that you had just met. It seems like nothing was off limits. And before we dive into kind of getting into the book, and we're going to have you read some passages here so people will get a taste for what the audiobook will be like. But I am curious, as this is the Struggle Climbing Show, if it was a struggle for you to essentially remove all the filters. It seemed like you did, at least as I was listening to this, that it didn't seem like anything was off limits. And that's what I found to be so refreshing and beautiful and human about it. But it also, if I was thinking about writing a memoir myself, though I haven't been through the experiences you have, I feel like it might be hard for me to just truly open up and bear everything. So I'm curious if that was a struggle or what the process was like for you just in general.
That's a good question. I don't feel like that was necessarily a struggle. I feel like that's probably the thing that I connect to most with books that I read or stories that I hear or people that I meet, is just like the humanness of all of us. And I feel like a lot of times in climbing, especially the time that I was kind of growing up in climbing, that was noticeably missing. And so, yeah, I think that I wasn't going to work on a book that was just this like shiny prepackaged hero's journey, you know, that we all have. We have plenty of those stories out there and, you know, they're inspiring in their own way. But I think that if I was going to work on a book and put it out there, it was going to be something that was relatable in many different ways and in the ways that I feel connected when I read something that someone has like truly opened up, and you don't feel as alone when you're reading their stories and that type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was so accessible and incredibly, as a result, I think incredibly relatable, even though I can't really relate to the experience of a girl becoming a woman in climbing and being abducted and going through these relationship ups and downs and reinventing yourself and the injuries and, you know, everything that you went through, most of which I haven't, but yet I was still relating to it and finding ways to relate to it. And so I credit your ability to bring the reader in and along for that journey. It was really beautiful. I can't wait to dive into my usual format here at The Struggle, but through the lens of these chapters and these experiences in your book. And the memoir, I think you were quite inventive and creative with how you take the reader through the journey by jumping forward and backwards in time and through different locations. And at least for the bulk of the book, for the first half, maybe two thirds, we're kind of bouncing between Kyrgyzstan and back home. And that might be in Colorado or in California, depending on where you were at. But we were jumping back and forth and how you're processing this pivotal life event, this formative experience that you had in Kyrgyzstan when, obviously, I think everybody in climbing, you know, knows the story, or at least the package story, as you would say, kind of the few lines or the 3-minute canned speech that you had rehearsed coming out of that. But you go into detail on that story in a way that I wasn't familiar with. And I had read the book that was written, you know, about that experience. I'd read Tommy's book, The Push, that where he kind of has his perspective on it. And now reading what you had to say in your book here, it's the deepest and most kind of visceral, I think, accounting of that event through your eyes, of course. You know, everybody's going to have their own memories from that, their own experience. But you really brought us along for the journey on that thing. And if we could, I'd love to start there and maybe have you read a passage from that, from page 83. And then I'd like to dive into and peel that back a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Abdul pointed for John and me to squeeze our bodies under a boulder right at the river's edge. I hoped the loud rush of the water would drown out the thoughts in my head. So I crawled to the very back of the narrow space, nearest to the river, and lay down, my head on a few small rocks and my nose mere inches from the bottom of the boulder. It was a coffin. I had no idea where Tommy and Jason had been taken, but John lay next to me. I was grateful.
Yeah, so this was, I think, a few days in after you all had been taken when you were on the side of the wall there in the valley. Is that right?
Yeah, I think this was the second day. So okay. 2 days in. Yep, the second day.
So by then you had been taken captive. You were on the side of a big wall, brought down. You were with someone who was local who I believe they had killed shortly after you had met him, right? And now you were being split up. You're on the run, not much food. You had grabbed some power bars, this kind of thing. I'm curious, just bringing us into this moment when you're like in the middle of it, what was that thought process, and what were kind of these conversations that you were having with your friends as you were traveling to and from these different hiding places?
I mean, I think that every possible thought that you could have, that one could have in that situation, I had. You know, I thought, well, we're going to die this minute. How much longer that the next minute? I want to be home. I'm hungry. I'm cold. Why are we here? What do they want with us? Just like, it was just like a blender of emotions that was going through my head. There was no coherent thought process. There was no rhyme or reason or method to how I was organizing my thoughts. But I have to say, and I hope that this came across in the book, that John, they split us up, you know, maybe they knew that Tommy and I were together, and so it was a tactical decision. Maybe not. We have no idea. But I was with John during the days, and Tommy and Jason were together. And John was just instrumental in keeping me afloat, if that makes sense. He was so good at redirecting and asking questions about totally mundane and neutral subjects like my parents and where did I grow up and what kind of dog did I have, to kind of distract me, I think. And then together, when we would be hidden during the days, and then we would kind of like roam and walk at night to the next hiding spot, we actually have no idea, you know, what they wanted with us. We can only guess that finding four Americans in the middle of their path was, you know, a good opportunity. But, you know, a lot of times we'd be checking in with each other. The boys talked about trying to escape a lot, trying to get on the captor's side, so they liked us. And I think that it wasn't, maybe some people think that you'd have a certain thought process or a certain tactic or whatnot, but we had no idea what was going on. You know, we were just thrown into this. It's not like we'd ever been practiced. None of us were, you know, experts at this, so we were just kind of doing our best. But I will say the boys were phenomenal. And, you know, I probably say with certainty that I probably couldn't have gotten through it without them. So they were great.
Yeah, I think that really did come across in your writings, especially the interplay between you and John and the way he was trying to keep you from spiraling, which seems like, you know, it worked, and you all were able to keep it together. And at times, I'm sure you all were supporting one another as needed. You know, it's a long time. Like, you all were out on the run for a long time. And as you said, it's not just one line of thought or one kind of one frame of mind that you're in. Do any moments of levity or humor or joy come to mind from being in truly the scariest, most awful situation imaginable?
You know, Jason is always pretty good at trying to bring light to situations. And same with John, to try and just hop on a different thought train. The second to last night, we found some yogurt balls and some butter in this hut, and we were all starving. So finding a little bit of calories was such a relief. But I don't know if there's, I can't think of a time and just, you know, pinpoint something to say, well, it was all dark except this one part was really good. I mean, right. For the most part, it was just not great.
Yeah. Just, I mean, it was incredibly gripping to read it. Like, my heart rate was up, and I just felt like I was like along for this ride and feeling those emotions. Ultimately, and you detail this throughout the course of the book as we're jumping back and forth, but ultimately you all do manage to escape. This is after Tommy had, while you all were climbing, had thrown Sue off the one of your captors. You only had one with you at this time and thrown him off the edge. The plan had been to try to escape in this manner, and the other guys had talked about doing it, but it maybe became clear in this moment that they weren't going to, or that the opportunity arose and it needed to be taken. And Tommy ended up doing that, but it sounds like you guys had this moment of connection just prior to that. And I'm interested to just kind of dive back into your memory of that and how you remember those few moments right before you ultimately saved your own lives and got free of the situation.
Yeah. You know, honestly, it's one of the, that moment is one of the moments that I really had to work on in therapy. Mm-hmm. Because it was this moment that I felt like I felt culpability to the decision. And then all this weight came with it, you know? What if something happened to Tommy? You know, what if Sue grabbed him? What if he couldn't do it? What if then Sue killed him? What if Tommy slipped going up to it? So yeah, the moment was we were climbing up this ridge, this cliff. I don't know what you want to call it. For climbers, it's an afterthought. You know, like we wouldn't really think about it. And it's like 5'1", 5'2", with like grassy ledges and stuff. But for our captor, he was visibly not comfortable. You know, he was asking for help. He was shaking. You know, the boys would like pull his hand up, give him a push on the foot or something like that to help him over these places where, you know, you and I and probably mostly people listening would never think about it. So it was a very obvious opening and opportunity to escape because Abdul, the main captor, had said that he was going to go back and get supplies at our camp. And we were supposed to meet him at the top of this ridge. And so there's four of us and one of him. Granted, he had lots of weapons and we had none. But, you know, as John and Jason had been saying the whole time, that if an opportunity came up, we should take it. And the opportunity came up. And we were just getting towards the top of the ridge, the cliff, whatever you want to call it. And Tommy walked over to me and he said, you know, our chance is dwindling, you know, it's coming to the end. And he asked, do you think I should push Sue off? And it's a big, and I don't think I didn't have words for this at the time, you know, I was 20. So, but now looking back at it, it's a big question. It's very weighted, right? Do you encourage your boyfriend, someone that you care deeply about, someone who's probably the kindest, most gentlest man you've ever met, to go put himself in harm's way and kill somebody? I mean, that's a pretty big decision for two kids, you know?
Yeah, it's the weightiest. And I understand why this was a moment that was explored in therapy. And you do a good job, I think, in the book, cutting back and forth and talking about this. And I do want to talk about therapy specifically a little bit later in this conversation here, because that was an interesting arc that you wove through the book, you kind of your relationship with therapy in general. But that moment, yeah, there are weightier moments that I can imagine in life at all than something like that, because to your point, you weren't trained in this. You haven't, it's not like you had worked on and contemplated escape or taking somebody's life or self-defense. This was just thrust upon you, and you did it. You took advantage as a group of that opportunity and made it back to safety. First, you were shot at by the military that ultimately then saved you and whisked you away, which I'm sure was a harrowing end to the experience. But you carried that experience in a much different way, I think, than Tommy did. And you note that in your book here, and you know, something that I noted in reading Tommy's book and kind of juxtaposing the experience. The events of the experience were the same, but how they impacted you and how you took them into your lives afterwards were very, very different. And I recall, I think the term you used in your book was post-traumatic strength, was maybe what Tommy was calling it. And it was obviously, that's a play on post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, which you were very much affected by and I'm sure still are. And so I'm curious, just as part of that reflection, you don't need to speak for Tommy, but you were in a close relationship and ultimately then got married after the fact. The way that experience the way you took that experience, or that experience took you afterwards, was vastly different. And I'm curious, just, you know, what your reflection is on that after you got back to safety.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's response to trauma is vastly different. And so I can't speak for Tommy or John or Jason. It's honestly something Tommy and I rarely, if ever, talked about when we were married. But for me, I had a really hard time putting language to it, because at the time, you know, I was just a kid, 20. I think Tommy was 22, Jason was probably like 23 or 4, and John was 25 or something. You know, this was back in 2000, and in the climbing community and even society as a whole, like, therapy wasn't widely accepted. I don't know, accepted, but it just wasn't widely talked about, at least in my like sliver of society. It wasn't like I knew friends that went to therapy, or even parents' friends or anything like that. It seemed much more this like peripheral thing that, you know, maybe if you were really sick or something, you would go to therapy. But other than that, you know, if you were tough and could get through it and get back on the horse, that's kind of what you did. So I remember coming back, and it was less of, oh my God, how are you doing? You know, are you okay? Like, what do you need? And more like, wow, that's amazing. You guys had the best epic. Like, good job. You survived. Like, so sick. You know, it was very like this celebrated thing, because there is some truth in, you know, the climbing community. We celebrate harrowing tales, right? It's like, yeah, you lost a toe or two or almost died getting to the summit, but you conquered the mountain type of thing. So I was having like pretty regular nightmares. So I did end up going to therapy. I was still on my parents' insurance at the time. So I think I had like 6 sessions that were approved by insurance. And so I went, but I just felt like I was weak. I felt ashamed going to therapy. I felt like it wasn't something I could really talk about. You know, here Tommy and John and Jason were totally fine. You know, they were free climbing El Cap and moving on with their lives, and I couldn't even sleep through the night. So I just felt very ashamed, honestly. There's probably not a better word for it. And I can't say why I was more impacted by the experience than others, but I just think that, you know, people's reactions and how they process things are just so vastly different as humans. And that's how I did it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you made that connection there, just to kind of that experience coming back and the climbing culture of it, as this is a climbing podcast, but you're a climber. Your identity was kind of wrapped up in your climbing, your performance, and most of your relationships were within that climbing community, which is a small community, even smaller than it is now. And so you've got this passage that you wrote on page 22 that I'd love for you to read from, as it pertains to struggle and the experience really that you just mentioned there.
Yeah, absolutely. Climbing culture had taught us both that doing hard things would only make us stronger, better. We trained hard, pushing our muscles to exhaustion so we could pull ourselves higher. We pulled on holds until our hands bled to grow calluses we needed to succeed. We ignored fear and pain in order to send. And we were good at it. We were professionals. But this hard thing didn't make me feel stronger. And I had no language to tell Tommy or anyone else how very fragile I felt. I couldn't show him this darkness. Could not tell him that I was still braced every second for the next threat.
Yeah, thank you for reading that. Your processing of this event was very different than everybody else's. And that's just the way something like this is going to be. Now that you reflect back, and it's been many years, and you've just experienced a lot of struggle, this is a question that I ask every guest on the show, but whether it's from this event or injuries or relationship or parenthood, you know, you've lived a pretty eventful life. Many of us have, but yours has maybe hit some extremes that are a little bit different than what anybody else has endured. What's your relationship with struggle? How do you feel you process struggle now, maybe compared to when you were younger?
That's a really good question. I feel like I'm not a good person with change, if that makes sense. I feel like my default, even through years of therapy and being a mom and being a human, I always feel safer if I have control. So I feel like I struggle when I don't feel in control. Hmm. And that can be applied to any topic, you know? It doesn't necessarily have to be climbing. It doesn't have to be therapy or some traumatic event or whatnot. And I feel like that's something that I don't know if I'd label it as a struggle, but it's something that I know I continue to work on, you know, and try and let go of a bit.
Parenthood will continue to teach us different ways to adapt with struggle. So we've got loads of lessons coming our way.
Yeah.
Well, I want to kind of dovetail into some climbing now. And, you know, the book is I found really interestingly balanced between incredible climbing achievements and goals and training and really geeking out over the stuff that us climbers love to geek out over. I think you made it very accessible for a non-climber. You explained some of the inside jargon and that kind of thing, but it didn't seem watered down or dumped down. You go into your first ascents and your projects and the training and the setbacks and all of the things that are wrapped up in climbing, but then juxtaposed with being abducted or the relationship between you and Tommy and Randy and, you know, the messiness that can happen in life around all of that. I mean, it's just really, I found, well-balanced. But for us climbers who crave climbing, you're one of the greatest climbers of all time. You've put up incredible first ascents, some of which didn't get repeated for a long time. Maybe some that haven't, right? If we're, I guess, talking about Lurking Fear. Has anybody repeated Lurking Fear?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Yeah. So, you know, just at the absolute pinnacle of climbing. And so I'd like to take this interview and try and strike some balance as well and geek out over climbing for a little bit here. So let's dive into the chapter that we do here on training. And I'll use a section from your book here on page 87 to kick off a little bit of nerdy training talk. And then we'll weave our way back into some of these other themes as well.
We'd made up this train to obliteration routine on our own with no science or rationale to back it beyond the fact that it made us happy and produced fairly good results. Back then, climbers didn't have access to cutting-edge research to help us perform. And now, I look back and cringe at how we punished our bodies. By dinner time, we'd have trained for 7 hours.
Yeah, if there's something that defined you in those maybe earlier, you know, years of climbing and putting up hard ascents, it was, I think Tommy could be included in this as well, as you were Beth and Tommy, as you write in one word in the book, was just this, like, I don't know, masochistic training, you know, just a kind of obsession, like just beating up and working in these medieval, you know, workout machines that Tommy's dad had crafted and like just going hard, really, really hard. And you just note right there, I think, interestingly, that there was no science or rationale, you know, beyond it. You were just essentially beating yourselves up and it was working. You were putting up the hardest routes in the world. But I'm curious, as you reflect back on that now, as there is a little bit more science behind training, just, you know, what you think you were doing right, what you think maybe you missed the mark on, and how that informs how you think about training now.
That's a good question. I feel like, you know, we were doing it right in that it brought us joy, you know, and it brought us happiness, and it was a place where we really thrived together. And so I feel like anytime you can kind of get those things lined up, then you're probably doing something right. Yeah. Could we have probably halved it, you know, and stopped at like 3.5 hours? Maybe. Could we have been more scientific and like hung on the hang board for 10 seconds instead of like climbing on the Woody for 4 hours? And for sure. But I mean, we had no idea. Like, people didn't know that back then. And honestly, for certain types of the things that we wanted to do, like, you know, I believe this passage is in reference to how to before we were training for doing the nose, but we also both well knew that that was just one thing. And then we were also training for Tommy to do the double. So it was like we actually needed to totally be obliterating ourselves for a really long time because, I mean, maybe I'm not a coach and I'm not a trainer and I haven't done my PhD on finger strength, but I mean, maybe there is a way to do that in a shorter amount of time on a hangboard, but I also kind of think, you know, you need to be be out in the sun and the wind, and you got to be climbing on rock and like kind of just going for it for a little bit longer than just a 2-hour gym sesh or whatever. So I feel like performance was one thing, but then kind of these overarching bigger things was another. And I'm sure there was a smarter way to do it. But again, you know, we did our best and it was really fun a lot of times, you know, so I feel like you can't fault that. You can't fault us for that.
Oh, totally. I mean, you're outside in one of the most beautiful places on earth and there's training, but there's also movement. And you talk a lot about this when you're talking about Meltdown and Magic Line and some of these other really hard things, Phoenix, where, you know, moving on granite is its own very unique thing. And it's like, you can't rehearse that on a fingerboard anyway. Like you can gain strength, but there's something about being connected to granite and the footwork and the body positioning. And I think you described that well. But also I love that you just touched on the joy, because when I'm reading about these all day sessions where you're climbing at the gym and then go to the garage and then do some cardio and then you're back in the garage and then you're passing out, you know, after dinner, like it all sounded very punishing, but that was a point of enjoyment. It sounds like it was punishing, but it was also fulfilling.
Yeah. And maybe I'm a little masochistic in my, in how I approach things, but I don't know. Like I still love when I have big days. There's just something that's so fun about it. You know, it's like you're outside all day or you've trained really hard or several parts during the day where you're like, I could go lay on the couch right now, but it also feels fun to, I still love that. I still love going to see how far I can go and that type of thing. So I think it's fun. And I think a lot of climbers feel that too.
Yeah, totally. We're kind of a sick breed, us climbers. But, you know, it's different today. And I think you reflected really well towards the end of the book on how your climbing and your training and just your outlook in general evolved. And this is coming off of nearly sending Magic Line, basically sending it and just kind of coming off that last jug there. So, you know, another one of the hardest climbs in the world. And then just hitting this run of injuries, A1 pulley and a torn labrum and broken ankle, I think, and then another shoulder injury. I mean, just really, you know, an unfortunate and very, very hard string of injuries. But then you kind of talk about coming out of that and having your son and then getting into a training mode that felt more like a weekend warrior. And so for those of us who are listening right now, myself included, who are not professional climbers, we've got families, we've got jobs, we're weekend warriors. I'm curious now, you've been on the one side, you're on the a little bit more on the other side. You're a little bit more on the kind of the weekend warrior side. What does your training look like now?
I have no rhyme or reason to my training now. I feel like any day that I can climb or quote unquote train is a great day. I feel like if I had all the time in the world, if I had no other commitments and nothing else to focus on, I'd probably, you know, climb 3 days a week. I realize as I get older and that type of thing, I just need more rest. But you know, if I can climb one day a week, I'm psyched. And then in France, I actually climbed 3 days on, which is just unheard of for me. So yeah. I feel like I don't really have a formula. Maybe I should get one, but that seems a little out of reach right now.
Yeah. No, it's super relatable. I mean, you're out there having fun, moving over rock as much as you can and just fitting things in when you can fit things in. So I appreciate that as somebody that's kind of in that camp myself. Let's shift gears. Let's talk about nutrition. And we could do a 3-hour conversation, you and me, just on nutrition. You've really, talk about struggle. I mean, you've really had an interesting and very charged relationship, I feel like, with nutrition. You do a really good job in the book of taking us through that thought process and that journey and the disordered eating and coming back from being abducted and the relationship with food that came out of that. So let's have you read a passage from page 21 there, and we'll talk a little bit around that and can also bring it current.
Okay. Before Kyrgyzstan, my eating was a point of constant fixation. I restricted. I obsessed. I binged. Now I saw coming back after real deprivation as a second chance, a possible reset. I was skin and bones from the days in captivity when we'd gone without food. This time, I would eat to be healthy, I told myself. not just to control a number on a scale. Don't mess this up, Beth. Just be normal.
Yeah, and that really just encapsulates kind of the relationship that you had with nutrition prior to Kyrgyzstan, what happened during your time in being abducted there and then coming out of it, and even trying to tell yourself to not screw it up, which, looking back, you know, was that a pivotal moment for you, or what was it ultimately that led you to more healthy relationship with food, do you think?
I feel like the healthy relationship with food, or, you know, the journey to try and get there, didn't come until later. It probably didn't come until after my divorce and after, during, I guess there's no after, but during a lot of my injuries, when I really felt that lack and that loss of control over my body that I had had for so long. Mm-hmm. And I feel like my relationship with food walked hand in hand with that control. And so when I felt like I couldn't control my body anymore, that my body was failing me, that my body wasn't living up to its side of the bargain, you know, it kind of just forced me to start to reevaluate my relationship with climbing, my relationship with food, just how I kind of wanted to have that in my life. And if I still wanted to have climbing, should it be healthy? Did I want to be at war with my body and what I put into it the whole time, you know, the rest of my life? So I feel like that's kind of when it came. So that wasn't until my early 30s or something like that. So well over 10 years after Kyrgyzstan.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And you really do, I think, explain well the kind of the ups and downs as you were working on different projects. And it was like a point of pride to go out and do like an epic day and only have one bar. And so it's interesting that you know that it kind of it can loop back to control, which makes sense. I think, you know, that resonates now that you're saying that out loud. It's such a charged thing in our sport. And I have a lot of conversations with athletes about nutrition and strength to weight ratio. And there is a benefit to being light in a healthy way and strong so that we can climb the hardest things we can climb. But also, it seems like a very slippery slope, I think, especially for women, but not exclusively for women. I've spoken with men on the show here who have had a history with disordered eating, and you've written about this, you've spoken about it. As you look at the sport where it's at right now, and there's been a lot of talk about Red S, or relative energy deficiency in sport for competitive athletes, but also just even those who are not competitive, but are just obsessed with performance, and that can include weekend warriors. Where do you think the issue is right now in the sport compared to 20 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, obviously everybody's relationship with food and their bodies is so uniquely and wildly personal. But I can say that looking back on when I started in climbing and, you know, my formative years as a teenager, as in my early 20s, climbing has come a long way. The community has come a long way. And I know some people are like, oh, we got to fix this. And, you know, they want an answer. But I think the biggest change that I've seen is just acknowledging it and not letting it just live in the shadows and kind of grow in the shadows. In that when I was a kid, no one talked about it, but it was everywhere. I mean, you look at pictures of when I was competing and when I was a teenager in the sport or in my 20s and, you know, a lot of us are just rail thin. And obviously everybody's bodies are shaped differently, but that was like the one body type that we saw, if that makes sense. Like there wasn't like here's a body type and then there's this multitude of other people that you can also look to that, you know, are climbing and having fun or excelling and, you know, pushing the sport, all that type of thing. It was like there was one way to do it. And, you know, as a young kid, you're just a sponge in the sport and you want to get better and you soak up everything you can and, you know, glean from heroes. And so I just soaked it up. And nowadays I feel like the fact that we're acknowledging it, that we're talking about it, that you hear about it in competitions and governing bodies on podcasts and magazines, you know, just, I feel like it's very widely talked about and, you know, hopefully it's giving enough of an opportunity for people that are struggling with it to see that they're not alone, that there's other ways that they can pursue, that there's paths to hopefully healing and that type of thing. So I think we've come a long way. Like, are we healed and are we fixed? No, but I don't know if that's ever a box you can check. But yeah, I think we're in the right trajectory.
Yeah, that's nice to hear. And I think, yeah, the more that it is in the open, the more people are talking about it, like you here on this show, but also in your book, the better. It just gives a voice to it and a shared experience for those out there who might be going through it as well. You mentioned chicken Caesar salad as your go-to in the book a few times. Is it still the go-to?
Sadly, I can no longer have dairy. Yep. So that is no longer a one for me, which is sad. Yeah, it's interesting. After Kyrgyzstan, I developed all these food intolerances and allergies. So.
Oh, interesting.
Yep. And I mean, I think trauma can impact the physical body as well as the mental body. So yeah, sadly, dairy and I are no longer coexisting.
what's the go-to fuel then for, like, if you're going to go out and do a big day, you know, out in the valley, biking and climbing?
Oh gosh, I really try and bring as much real food as possible. I feel like living in California, I'm like slightly spoiled in that way. But even like when we're traveling in France or Norway or wherever, I just try and bring like a Tupperware of leftovers. So I guess if you're like going fast and light and you can only bring something, you know, I'd probably bring bars and dried fruit and stuff like that. But when possible, I try and weigh myself down with normal food.
Yeah, great. Me too. I love it. I love bringing like a burrito to the crag or, you know, some leftover pizza. All right, just a quick breather here to ask you a really dumb question. Do you want to climb with one of the best sport climbers in the world? And do you want to take your projecting and nutrition game to the next level? Of course you do. What a dumb question. Now you can, y'all, with Jonathan Segrist and Shayna Savoy. I love them both so much. It just doesn't get cooler than this. Starting June 1st, Jonathan and Shayna are offering a 3-month climbing and nutrition program with Shared Air, custom made for a max of just 30 climbers. And check out what this program includes here. A masterclass on projecting with one of the best projectors in the game, 4 Zoom courses with J-Star on projecting and 4 with Shayna on nutrition, an in-person clinic with both Jonathan and Shayna, and then also, get this, a dream climbing trip to 10 Sleep where you're going to put all the learnings to practice with your new coaches / besties. What? And just for us strugglers, Shared Air is offering a $300 discount on the program, which shakes out to just $66 per month if you choose the monthly payment plan. That is cheaper than a gym membership. Let's go. If you are looking for a life-changing experience as a climber, this is it. Hit that link in your notes or pop over to thestruggleclimbingshow.com/sharedair and use code STRUGGLE to get that $300 discount. Shared Air, where climbing lives. Shout out to Scarpa, the official shoe sponsor of the Struggle Climbing Show, and my favorite shoes. Oh my gosh, I've been climbing in Scarpas for a decade, and I absolutely love the way that they fit and how they perform on rock and at the gym. The Instinct VSs have been a game changer for me, you guys, on the steep climbing that I'm doing over here at the Red. They just toe in and stick to everything. And also on the moonboard and the sets at the gym, I gotta say, I'm just able to move with such confidence and put more weight on my feet, which is such a good thing, because my fingers are pretty weak and I can use all the help that I can get. So whether you're a weekend warrior like me or a pro like Sean Rabatou, Nina Williams, Nathaniel Coleman, Alex Puccio, Jordan Cannon, Maddie Hong, oh my gosh, what a team. Scarpa has got you. They've been sustainably making the best footwear for climbers, trail runners, skiers, and hikers since 1938. I love my approach shoes. I love my climbing shoes. And I think you will too. You can shop the whole collection over at scarpa.com. Scarpa, no place too far. Let's talk about tactics. I'm super excited to dive in and geek out a little bit over some of the routes that you've done here in the climbing. And so tactics, I'd like to talk about your work on the nose. And I believe this passage here that you're going to read from page 140 is about the changing corners.
Yeah. Okay. Finally, hanging on the rope one day, my forehead resting against the cool granite, I found my fix. The crack extended below where we were trying to come in, and I wondered for the first time if it might be possible for me to approach it from farther down. I lowered down, my fingers fit. I tried a few moves. They were hard, but doable. It was counterintuitive, but coming in lower, adding in another 10 feet or so of hard climbing below the infamous 10 feet, just might work.
So sick. So epic. You know, you're working on the nose here. At this point in time, Lynn Hill was the only one who had freed it. Is that correct?
Scotty Burke as well. However, climbers are always very nitpicky and things. So I feel like some people put an asterisk next to his name. But I think for Tommy and me, we thought we were going to do this third and fourth free ascent, if that makes sense.
Got it. Yep. So either way, there wasn't a whole lot of beta for up there. You guys were figuring this stuff out on your own. Tommy was doing it in a way where he was able to reach through and climb it in a way that you were not able to. And so I found this really fascinating. I didn't know that this is how you dissected the changing corners. And a lot of focus is put on the great roof there, but this was the crux for you, was the changing corners. And you approached it by adding more difficulty. And so I'd love for you to talk about that just as it pertains for those of us who are trying to figure out ways through whatever our version of the changing corners might be.
Yeah, absolutely. So Lynn and Tommy and Scotty, and I think most people probably to this day that have done it, they go in partway up the changing corners. And it's this like total max span. And it was to the point where I could reach tip to tip. But you know, when you're so spread out, like you can't even turn your head, you know, that's like how spread out I was. So it wasn't like I could reach from the corner to the corner, but then I couldn't like look to see where to put my foot. So it was just like an impossible situation. Lynn might just have like a half inch on me, or she's also Lynn, so she could probably be in that same position and not need to see her feet. She's just superhuman.
Right.
But I am not superhuman, so I could not do it that way after many, many times of trying. But the changing corners goes down further, like the crack, the actual corner of the crack goes down further, and it narrows as you go down. And so I was like, well, maybe I'll just try to go in down there. And, you know, my fingers are smaller than Tommy's, so there weren't pin scars there to put in, but I was able to like get enough purchase on that part of it. And yeah, I feel like that's something in climbing that I love, that I always love, that I love to this day, like working out with friends, you know, down in the valley or out in the forest or whatever, is different ways to do it. You know, you're not just like pigeonholed into a certain way. Like you can use a small little nub, or like they went left hand to it, and you could match hands or something. I feel like just thinking outside the box is always something that's fun for me in climbing.
Really cool. Again, you go into such great detail as you're working on some of these infamous routes or pitches, that the Phoenix was a great passage. Meltdown, of course, just really, really fascinating going into the tactics. And it's especially hard, I feel like, when somebody hasn't done it. So we're talking a first ascent. Can it go? Will it go? And you talk about the emotion on lurking fear of trying to figure things out and just crying on the wall because you can't, or your fingers are bleeding because you've been trying so much. And everything really, I feel like, kind of comes to its zenith on your work on the meltdown. And that went a decade before being repeated. Who knows if it could have gone, you know, you were just like there trying to sort this stuff out. And as you reflect on that, tactically speaking, what stands out is maybe the thing that unlocked meltdown, at the time the hardest trad climb in the world. It's still one of the hardest trad climbs in the world.
Gosh, I don't know if there was like a moment that put it together, but I feel like I'm a pretty stubborn person, which I think is a blessing and a curse, you know? And so if I even think there's like the slightest possibility that it's possible, then I'll just keep pounding my head against the wall. You know, I started on meltdown on a lot of hard projects, and it's like you can only do a fraction of the moves, but you're like, well, maybe one day if I got stronger, or if I figure out this part of the puzzle or whatnot, you can do it. And so, yeah, I feel like just even having the possibility of, you know, it might go, that's kind of like what always kind of keeps me going. Even today, you know, if it's like, it's not something cutting edge, you know, but I'm like, oh, maybe if I practiced, or maybe if I figured out something here. And that's what I really like. I mean, I really love the problem solving aspect of climbing. I think it's one of the coolest things, because it's not just this like purely physical pursuit. You know, there's a lot else that goes into it, at least for me. And I really like that part of it.
Yeah, it's cool. I just felt like I was along for the ride with the projecting process there, and it's just gripping. Like, I know you sent, but like, as I'm reading it, I'm like, oh my God, is she gonna send? It was, it was really, you did a very good job with that descriptive language. It's like when I was watching Free Solo, I'm like, I know he lived, but like, is he gonna live? So
Totally.
great, great story.
I remember that.
Yeah. It's like a very visceral experience climbing.
Yeah.
Well, this dovetails very well into the mental game chapter here, because we're talking about wondering, will it or won't it, and is there that window, and really controlling the mind on a lot of these climbs. Again, whether for us our limit is V4 or V14 or whatever, like we're all kind of hitting our limits. It's very relatable. So I pulled a couple quotes here. I'd love for you to read this one from page 144 to kick off the mental game chapter.
Yeah, absolutely. To be at my best, I need to be the quiet force, not the loud one. That's when I shine. That's when I succeed. It's as though I open a door in my mind and walk down a hallway with authority, good authority. Understanding the rock, but also listening to my body, knowing exactly how hard I need to try while still saving some for the top. It feels like the pendulum of my grandfather's clock in my parents' house. Steady, calm, back and forth, back and forth. Push hard, pull back, balance.
I love this window inside your mental game when you're approaching flow state and you're really trying to do, the hardest thing that you've ever tried to do. And you mentioned this a couple times on a couple routes, this kind of opening up this door and walking down the hallway. I'd love to just learn a little bit more about your mental game and how you try to attain that focus and set yourself up to access flow state, whether it's, trying Meltdown or the Phoenix or a boulder in Font that's a, V5. Like we're all trying to achieve that and attain that, and we're all dealing with pressures and anxieties and thoughts and doubts. And what's been working for you, and maybe just peel back a little bit on what you just touched on there.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like I said, I'd never thought about it before. There was no formula that I knew or could access to get there. It's just somewhere where I went,
Mm-hmm.
and I don't want to say like quite easily, like I had it all figured out, but like I think I was good at when it needed to be go time, that it was go time. And so this was the first time I was like, what do I even do? I have no idea what I do. And I remember this day bouldering. It was just me and my husband up in Tuolumne. And I was coming back from some injury or another, I don't know. And it was like kind of high. I mean, not like highball. I'm not like a good highballer, but high for me, to the point where I was like thinking about the fall. And it was like a harder move for me at the top. And I remember being in this place where like, oh, I know what I need to do mentally to just go for it, right? I know how to think about this. I know where to put my brain. I know how to like quiet the things in that are chattering, that, the fall, could I hurt myself? Is this worth it? Like all the questions that are running through my head. And I was like, okay. But then I remember thinking, nope, I'm not ready for that yet. So I do really remember that was one of the moments where I was like, oh, actually, there is this way when I do make a choice on whether to step into that hallway, right? Whether to like leave those things behind and close the door and just like, trust in myself and go for it. And I think when I was younger and kind of at the peak of my career, there was never really a question of whether I walked into that hallway. It was just like, oh, now we walk in and now you do your thing type of thing. Whereas now, I don't know if it's because I'm older and I'm definitely not going to say wiser, but I'm just like, well, I really don't want to be injured for the next 3 months. Or, if I'm just, let that chatter have a little too much voice. But sometimes I back out of the hallway when before I know I would have just stepped through it. So I think it was hard to figure out how to describe that and how to make it understandable, because it's so wildly unique and personal to how I do it. I'm sure everybody has different things. But I do remember that moment of being like, oh, do I actually go there right now? And I remember very much so being like, nope, I'm not going to go there. And I do remember one other time, actually, on this route called Sarcasm. So it was when I was in the peak of my career. I was in my early 20s, mid-20s, something like that. And it's this beautiful arete at like 14,000 feet. It's this 514 that Tommy put up, and it's just gorgeous. And I'm just, I think I touch on this a lot in the book, but I'm a pretty scared person when I climb. Like, I'm not one of those no fear people. Like, I definitely have a lot of fear. And arets are always like, oh, how do you fall? Are you going to swing around? Are you going to hit the middle of there? You know? And so I remember being like, there was this quick draw, like right in front of my face. And I had to do this hard move. And I was quite a bit above the other bolt. And I was like, oh, I could just grab this quick draw and it would be all fine. And then that's when I was younger, that I was just, I like walked into the hallway and I just did the move and then I did the route. So for me, I think the mental game is just pretty personal, but it's been pretty fascinating in the book writing process to figure out that I actually have a mental game and a mental, you know, way of approaching things.
That's so cool. Thank you for that window into the kind of the mental process there and the conscious decision that you can make. Do you still, because you said in that on that boulder, you did not. You said, oh, okay, I can walk in or I cannot, and you chose not to. Do you choose to walk in sometimes still, or has that passed?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, all the time. I think that moment was just the first time that I realized I had this choice, you know, whereas before I was always like, well, this is just something I do, you know.
Got it.
Like even that time on Sarcasm, I didn't have language for it at the time. I was just like, oh, well, I wasn't a wimp and grabbed the draw. I just like forged ahead, you know, type of thing.
Right.
Whereas this time I was like, oh, right, that's where I make that choice on whether to keep pushing or not. And yeah, I do it all the time. And now I actually know there's a choice, you know. And so like even, you know, this last trip to Font, I'm recovering from a pelvic floor injury. So it's like I didn't want to go very high and potentially fall. But there were a lot of times where I was like, oh, no, I've got this actually, and was able to step into that hallway.
Yeah, cool. Love it. Love that it's accessible at all levels and that you're like familiar with it now. That's really cool. I think that's something that we can all try to gain a little bit more awareness of, our kind of where are our thoughts, where are our emotions when we're on route and when we're about to try hard.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. And obviously it doesn't always work out, but it's like cool to analyze how you approach things, you know.
Just continuing on the mental game, this is my favorite chapter, so I always dive a little bit deeper in the mental game than the others. You had something to say coming off of Meltdown. This is on page 185 that I'd love for you to read, because I think there's something quite interesting and relatable to climbers that came from this here.
Okay. The years of climbing had abused my body, and Meltdown had taken a particular toll on the ligaments in my fingers and hands. I needed a break, mentally and physically, from the climbing and training and the pressure to perform, to excel. The endless cycle of setting a goal, chasing it, achieving it, basking briefly in the resulting praise, and then immediately choosing a new, even harder target. Rinse, repeat. I wanted to sit on a beach, eat ice cream, be normal. But I had no idea how to take a vacation. Neither Tommy nor I did.
Yeah, I'm feeling this right now, because I just feel like, you know, there's something so climbery about topping the boulder or clipping the anchors of the hardest thing ever and lowering off and then just being like, all right, what's next? You know, or people are already asking you like, okay, well, what's, you know, you just did your 12D, where's your 13A, which is the land that I'm in right now. And so it can be kind of stressful. It's exciting to have goals. It's exciting to achieve, but it can also kind of be stressful. And so the conflict that I'm hearing from you talking about this is that like you were exhausted and you wanted to take a vacation, but you didn't know how to. And I'd love to just peel back on that for a second.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I feel like obviously there's a lot behind it, you know, with Kyrgyzstan and not, and like just diving into climbing and going full force on that. But, you know, it's like an amazing process and way to live and succeed in climbing, right? You set these goals, you work really hard, you train, you conquer, you get all this like praise, whether it's like a movie about you or magazine covers or just like, you know, a little check mark in your guidebook next to the climb that you want to do. But then it's never like, I always thought that would fill this void or like quench this thirst or like lead to some all-knowing happiness or something like that. And I feel like with every climb, even the nose and meltdown, although those at least gave me a little bit of a pause, it was always like, what's next? You know, what's next? And it was internal and it was also external. So it was like, I was asking myself, other people were always asking me. And so it was kind of like this addicting way to be, you know?
Yeah.
It was like, you shoot for a goal, you succeed, and then like you get all this praise, you feel really good, and then you kind of like get let down, and so you're like, I gotta go bigger, and you go again and again and again. It just felt a little bit like unsustainable in a way. But that's not to say like I still have goals, right? It's not like, but I think there's healthier ways to, for me at least, to have them, right? Like I think back then it was kind of like all that I was hanging on were these success stories and these roots, and it kind of like propped me up. It falsely propped me up for a long time. And so I think if you can have like a bigger base of other things that prop you up, it's a lot better. And then these can just be like the cherries on top, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I like that perspective. You did a short film with Outdoor Research that I remember watching where this was, you know, coming off of a lot of injuries, and it ended with you doing, I think, something quite moderate, maybe up in Tuolumne. And you talked about just the joy and the fulfillment that can come from just being out and moving over rock and being in nature. And not once did you mention, and climbing the hardest thing I had tried to climb or taking the next grade. And so I wrestle with this myself because I'm a little bit grade obsessed right now. Admittedly, I'm like maybe, you know, aware that I won't be at my physical peak for much longer now being in my mid-40s. And I'm getting a lot of joy from it, to be honest, because I didn't start climbing until I was 30. So like I'm still able to rise through the grades and climb the hardest thing ever. At some point in time I won't, but I also like get a little stressed out by it. And so I'm always appreciative of and almost envious in some ways of this idea of just like going out and just getting so much joy and fulfillment regardless of the grade or, you know, the achievement. And yeah, I'd love to just understand a little bit more, if I could, of that perspective that you have now. You have a long lens of perspective and finding fulfillment in the experience as opposed to the achievement.
Yeah, I think that obviously it's a constant journey for me, you know, and I think it's one that I'll probably just always be trying to sort out. But I do think that I have the privilege of being able to climb really hard things for me and in climbing and see and remember how that made me feel or didn't make me feel versus, you know, through a long process, how I can enjoy a day out now, right? And I think if I hadn't had that contrast, then I wouldn't have been able to contrast that, right? Like if I hadn't been able to free the nose and understand the aftermath and how I felt after that. Obviously, like I felt amazing in a lot of ways because it was this lifetime goal. It was something that my hero in climbing had done. It was something I never thought I could do. But it also wasn't the thing that totally filled me up forever, like I kind of made it out to be, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I'm not saying that you know, I went out and did a little circuit at Camp 4 this morning. I'm not saying that I feel like the same sense of accomplishment as I did when I stood on top of the nose, but I also feel like maybe that's not something to always need to shoot for me at least. Like, I had an amazing morning this morning. You know, I was able to go out and do like 15 boulder problems, and I only saw one person, and he was somebody that I like, and it was a friend, you know, and just like had a great time. And I'll probably be sore tomorrow, which is also a bonus. So I feel like having that contrast, and it wasn't like this linear, super easy path to get from the, you know, the nose to here. There was a lot of like, why can't I climb hard anymore? I hate my body. I hate myself. I hate climbing. I'm going to quit. I'm going to go. You know, it's like back and forth, this yo-yo. But, you know, just realizing that climbing hard is really fun. And it's really fun to like push yourself and push the grades. And I still do it. You know, like I have this list of like 7 A's in font that I would love to be able to do. And some of them are probably easier than 6 B's. But, you know, it's like that magical 7 A, you know, that I want to get to. But then I also really have fun on like the 5B mantle that I can't do, you know? So I feel like kind of trying to see both sides, that it's not one or the other, you know, it's both. Like, it can be fun to grade chase, and it can be fun to like want to climb your hardest. And then if that doesn't happen, some days it's like can be fun to just go out and climb with your friends. Like, I feel like that nuance is something that isn't necessarily really celebrated in sport. You know, it's like you succeed or you fail. So I think it can be both, you know. It's like you can go climb a 13A and be really driven to do it and really psyched if you do it, and then also feel kind of bummed that maybe now you want to climb a 13B, or maybe you have a whole season where you climb 510 and it's fun. I don't know. So I think it's just like the balance of trying to find the balance, which is like always impossible, but you know, it can be fun to try.
Yeah. Oh my God, a whole season of 510 sounds so delicious right now. I think,
see,
I'll be there sooner than later. And if I learned something from your book about doing that mantle, it's just like, take the shirt off and get that skin on there so you can get that skin friction. That's the beta for mantles, right?
I feel like in font, the more skin you get on, the better.
Let's wrap up the mental game chapter here, if we can, by just talking about therapy. And we touched on this earlier, but it was an interesting through line coming back from Kyrgyzstan, having a handful of what kind of felt like maybe obligatory therapy sessions, and then going away from it and bringing in therapy again around your relationship and couples therapy, and going away from it and back to therapy, you know, as you had your son and wanted to truly work through some of this trauma. I found that to be a really interesting arc in the book. And I'm curious what you learned, you know, as you look back from those various seasons in your life as it pertained to truly like putting a focus on mental health and through those therapy sessions.
Yeah, I know we talked about the first one a bit. And so I feel like the first one didn't feel, it helped with the nightmares, right? So it helped with like this very acute issue that I was having. It wasn't like I even admitted to myself that it worked in a way. I don't know how to explain it. It was like, yes, it worked, but it's supposed to do its job, but climbing's way better. You know, it was like, it was just this very dismissive attitude I had around therapy. And especially like afterwards, I kind of just like went full force into climbing and the climbing community and like the bravado around it. So it wasn't until my divorce that I went to therapy that I kind of like a little light bulb went off, and I was like, like there's other ways to think about things. And like, I never would have even thought of that, you know? And I remember like when I first was going to therapy, she asked about Kyrgyzstan, and I was so dismissive. Hmm. I was like, wait, no, I literally just need help with my divorce. Like, you don't need to, not, I'm fine with Kyrgyzstan. Like, I don't need to talk about that. And I think she was probably like, okay. But so yeah, I feel like the divorce, when I went to therapy for divorce, it was the first time I was like, wow, there's a lot of different ways you can think about things. There's a lot of ways that you can approach things mentally that I would have never even considered. And then finally, like, And I don't think I'm done with therapy for Kyrgyzstan. I still go back, you know, when things bubble up and that type of thing, or when my anxiety, I think that's how a lot of things show it themselves right now to me, is I have pretty bad anxiety. So I still go back occasionally. But when I went back to for Kyrgyzstan 5 or 6 years ago, that's when I was felt like I really appreciated what therapy can do and how helpful it can be. And that probably just like anybody that wants to train in a certain way and goes to somebody who knows something about training, or, you know, or has injured their shoulder and they find like a really good shoulder doctor or something like that. It just kind of was like eye-opening because I had buried Kyrgyzstan for so long, you know, something like over 15 years. It felt very perilous and a little bit reckless to try and go back to those thoughts, because I just had buried them so deep, and I was able to kind of live this fine life, you know, without ever having to unearth it. I was like, why would I ever unearth that? Because what is it going to let out? You know,
right.
Is it like, am I ever going to be able to sleep through the night? Am I ever going to be able to, you know, go in a crowd of people? Am I ever going to be able to do anything like that? So having a professional kind of like walk through that was really eye-opening, and, you know, I'm just super grateful for it.
Thank you for that. And thank you for sharing it so well in the book, just taking us along for that journey. I think that it's just a tool. It's a resource that so many people, if we're fortunate enough to have access to, can be incredibly helpful. And it was nice to see your evolution of skepticism and acceptance, and ultimately, you know, really benefiting from, you know, that tool, that resource in your life. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about life now. Let's shift to kind of our final chapter here, which I typically call kind of the purpose or the passion chapter. And you end the book, you know, in kind of current, bringing things current. And you've had your son, and you're out climbing, and you've become a real voice for just, I think, being kind of authentic as a human with climbing and sponsors and having a real person's body and pay disparity and, you know, issues with sexism in the sport. There's so much that I think you've become a really shining example and a voice for in our sport, and then just beyond, just like things that, you know, you're just like living your life, of course. So I'm curious, like, what you're most excited about and what you're most passionate about as it pertains to everything that's happening in today's life for you.
I don't know if I have like one thing that I'm super excited about or super into. I feel like there's a lot of good things and there's a lot of not so good things, and it's just all part of being a human. Any day that I get to go out and go climbing or go for a walk or hang out with friends, I mean, it all kind of fills me up, you know? And so I feel like those little joys are kind of what make the world go around.
Yeah. I mean, there's such joy in just being able to get out and, you know, being a person and a climber and a parent and having time to do any and all of it. I'm certainly in that boat myself. You're also, you know, someone who is a superstar, a celebrity in the climbing world, and you're a professional climber, but not in the way that you were before, right? Like you're sponsored, but you don't have the pressure to go put up cutting edge things, and you're being recognized for your voice and your perspective on the sport. You had a post just recently. It was a picture of you when you were younger and you were all like greased up and like, you know, hugging some male model, or I don't know, the image was cut off, but it was like basically selling sex. And you talk about this in the book as well, where you're out doing photo shoots and the girls were expected to have their shirts off where the guys maybe weren't. And I'm curious, as you look at climbing culture and the business of climbing now, having gone through a bit of an evolution of the sport where, you know, women were, I think you were saying you were getting, you know, a third less pay than Tommy while you were out doing the same accomplishments. Just what does the sport look like? What does the landscape of climbing look like for a professional now, do you think? And How are you fitting into that? You're kind of riding your own way, it seems like.
Yeah, gosh, I feel like it's so varied now, right? I feel like when I started climbing, it was very, there was kind of like one path. It was the magazine era, right? So it's like you went and you pushed the sport forward and you were acknowledged in the magazines and they covered you and then sponsors noticed you and then you just like, that was the cycle, right? So it wasn't like self-promotion. In fact, that was super frowned upon. You would be likely not taken, you would be likely not given a sponsorship because you were known as like a self-promoter. It was just like much more old school in that way.
Yeah.
So now I feel like it's a blessing and a curse, right? It's like people can kind of write their own path a lot more and talk about what's important to them. But then you probably get people that maybe aren't the best ambassadors for the sport, having a super big voice, or you get people that would never have had a chance that are amazing ambassadors for the sport and now are getting a platform to do it. So it's really interesting. I feel like social media is just what I said, like it's a blessing and a curse in that I feel like I struggle with social media, but I've also had amazing experiences on social media, like connecting with people that I would have never connected with and like being able to talk about things that I would have never been able to talk about before, because it's kind of like it's on your own terms and you get to do that. So yeah, it's a totally vastly different landscape. And I don't know how younger climbers differentiate themselves. It seems really hard. So I feel a little bit privileged in that way that I didn't need to kind of make my name in the social media era. But yeah, how I'm fitting in, I don't know. I'm just kind of like bumbling my way through life like all of us. Maybe some things, you know, stick and people, you know, can relate to it, and maybe some things don't. And I feel like, yeah, I'm definitely not an expert in it. I'm just kind of doing my best and going along.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate it. I love the stuff that you share on Instagram. And in this book, I think it's just going to go a long way for those who have a chance to read it, to listen to it. I highly, highly, highly recommend it. It is a human, beautiful, flawed, tragic, joyful, triumphant, messy story. And if you love climbing and just like the experience of life, I couldn't recommend it enough. And I'm glad that you put this out. I'm sure it wasn't easy, but thank you for doing it. And thank you for sitting down and having this conversation. It's just been such a joy, Beth.
Oh, thank you for having me. And yeah, thank you for taking the time to listen to the whole book. I know it's a big time commitment, so I appreciate it.
All right, that clips the anchors here on this conversation with Beth. Her book just hit shelves, y'all, and I cannot recommend it enough. It's called A Light Through the Cracks. Do yourself a favor and dive into this book, whether you read it or you listen to it like I did. Just get it ASAP. And if you want even more from one of the absolute goats of this sport, you can dive into the bonus episode that I just released on Patreon and Apple subscriptions, where Beth shares what Lynn Hill taught her, how she's finding joy in climbing after experiencing so many injuries, how to make the leap from sport to trad to big walling, why she feels it's harder to be a short climber in the gym compared to being outdoors, and how she compensates for tall person gym settings, and so much more. You can get instant access to all of that right now at zero cost with a free trial over at patreon.com/thestruggleclimbingshow or right there in your Apple Podcast app if you're an iPhone person. And you'll also, by the way, get instant access to more than 40 hours of other bonus content featuring Adam Andra, Chris Sharma, Nina Williams, Alex Honnold, and so many more, plus the pro clinics that we've done on Stronger Fingers with Dr. Tyler Nelson, Advanced Bouldering with Allison Vest, Moonboard with Ravioli Biceps, and Performance Hacks with Hazel Finlay, just to name a few. It's all there for just a few bucks a month or zero cost right now with a free trial, so you can check it out. Thank you so much for supporting the show if you can. I'm working really hard for you here. huge thanks and appreciation to our show sponsors who have brought you this episode at zero cost. Check your show notes for links and special discounts from those guys that are only available to Struggle listeners. And also, you can see all of the show's brand sponsors and special deals by just popping over to thestruggleclimbingshow.com/deals. The Struggle is carbon neutral in partnership with the Honnold Foundation. Awesome. This episode was produced and hosted by me, Ryan Devlin, and The Struggle is a proud member of the Plugtone Audio Collective, a diverse group of the best, most impactful podcasts in the outdoor industry. You can follow along with the show on YouTube and Instagram at The Struggle Climbing Show, and you can also shoot me a note there. I'd love to hear from you. I hope training and climbing are going awesome, and if you're struggling like me, well, at least The Struggle makes us stronger.